Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to the 36th episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nesloni. I'm one of your hosts tonight. You can find me on Twitter at TechNinjaTodd. Chris Kessler will be with us momentarily. He is restarting his computer, and so he's been having some issues, got a new one, and already problems. So he'll be joining us in just a minute. But I would also like to introduce to you a brand new addition to Edu All-Stars. We started out with three hosts, and due to having a very, very busy family, Stacey Huffine hasn't been able to be with us most of it, and so we have picked up a new third co-host, and so I'll go ahead and let him introduce himself.
Hello, I'm Keegan Wade. I'm a high school senior from Michigan, and I was on a couple weeks ago, so some of you may already know me. And I'm really excited.
If you watch a few episodes ago, you can see Keegan and learn about him. But we are excited to have him join the show. Tonight, our guest is Alan Sitomer. He is California's 2007 Teacher of the Year. In addition to having been an inner-city high school English teacher and former professor, he is a nationally renowned speaker specializing in engaging reluctant readers. And he's also authored 16 books. And so, welcome, Alan. We are so happy to have you on the show tonight.
Excellent. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm very fired up.
And so for those people who aren't watching or just listening, where can they find you online, Alan?
Online? You can find me at my website, which is pretty simple, www.alansitomer.com. That's pretty much the go-to thing for me right there. But you know, I have a presence in Amazon, Pinterest, YouTube, Twitter. It's insane, right? I'm everywhere. I'm scattered. You know, just it's overwhelming, I think.
Yep, I understand. So tell us a little bit about your background, Alan. How did you end up in education?
I ended up in education because I think there's a law that shoves 5-year-olds into kindergarten. So that was when it first began. I was a kid that went to these really elite private schools when I was in elementary school. And then my parents got divorced, and we sort of went bankrupt, lost all our money, and I was suddenly thrust into a new world of urban public schools, if you will. And I was shocked in a lot of ways. One way was that I was kind of being asked to do stuff that we had done 2-3 years ago in private school, which sort of fed that side of me to become a class clown, and I just goofed around and played around. But I was like school, I liked learning, and I just started helping my friends out with their stuff and their studies, and I was like, yo, man, this ain't so hard. And that is when I think I discovered sort of the power of stories and laughs and humor to get through to people, especially kids. And it's just been one of those things that I've enjoyed doing my whole life. And, you know, lo and behold, I've made a career out of it.
Now, where did you start? What did you start teaching?
I started teaching prior to such things as, like, Google Hangouts, if you can believe such an era. There weren't even cell phones. You know, kids are going to ask, was there even electricity? You know, that kind of thing. I started teaching, but you know, I've kind of always been a teacher. In college, I didn't flip burgers. I had a job helping student athletes in the academic department, stuff like that at the university. So it's always been sort of woven in to me. It's not like, when did you start teaching, but when haven't I been a teacher? And I had always wanted to become an author as well. So it's kind of the mix of the two right there for me, that I started writing for the students that were in my class when I finally became a high school teacher. And that's what sort of opened up my novel career.
So did you start in the university, or did you start in public schools?
I started as, like most everybody else, I think, as a substitute teacher. And looking back, I was a middle school substitute teacher for PE one day. I woke up that morning thinking, this is the cushiest gig you could ever have, right? I roll the ball out, and I pick the ball back up. And then I show up, right? And I'm like, okay, everybody sit down, I'm going to take attendance. And some little, snot-nosed seventh grader looks at me, goes, up yours, man, and runs away. And suddenly I realize there is nobody with less authority on the planet than a substitute PE teacher. No. That thing was brutal. So that was like welcome to the world for me. Like, what am I going to do, go to the principal and be like, I'm having behavior issues? Like, dude, you're a substitute PE teacher. Make sure they don't kill each other. How hard is it?
Very cool. Yeah, very cool. Now, what are some of the major differences that you noticed between working as a professor and in the public school system, like you said?
In a way, it's interesting because I always sort of thought I wanted to become a tenured professor in a way. But the truth of the matter is I had a lot more just fun teaching high school. That was it. It just felt like everybody kind of finds their level in a way. And I taught preschool. I've worked with elementary kids, middle school. But for me, high school was the place that really resonated. And between public and private, there's on one hand, there's no difference at all. Kids are kids are kids. A 15-year-old is a 15-year-old is a 15-year-old. On the other hand, America is not really divided by race, despite what the news reports might lead you to believe. What we have is a socioeconomic divide that is separating America. And really, it's not about the color of your skin, but it's kind of about the degree of affluence or lack of affluence of your parents that is such a significant shaping force in education today. And kind of, that sort of, I guess to your question of what is sort of the biggest difference is you got some kids that are showing up. They're walking Wi-Fi hotspots 24/7. They're wired, they're dialed, they've got every new piece of technology. And then you got other kids showing up to school and they didn't even have breakfast that morning, And these two kids in a lot of major cities across the country, they live 15 miles apart from one another. It's not like a different state. It's like, it's a 20-minute drive type of thing. That's modern-day America for us.
Now, you started venturing outside the classroom and speaking at different conferences. When did that, and how did that come about?
It's interesting. Part of it came out because as a classroom teacher, I was subjected to a lot of professional development that just stunk. Right? Just stunk, and it's like there are people going through the motions, and if you're a teacher in the crowd right now, you're probably rolling your eyes saying, I've been there. And so a part of me just was like, I can do better. That was the first part. And then there were some things that I was doing that were sort of innovative at the time. I was incorporating hip-hop and building bridges between sort of classic poetry to modern sort of street lit in a way, and showing how the literary devices and standards aren't these far off things, but people are standing on the shoulders of those who came before us and stuff like that. So that was sort of my entree into the conference world, and that led to, I was writing books, and so the conferences started inviting me, and then sort of next thing the sessions start to become more popular, and word spreads, and then when I became, teacher of the year for the state of California, and that was when it just sort of exploded, and you get this sort of national recognition because California is such a big state, and it's led to places that you never imagine you're going to kind of end up in.
Yeah. I know you've also authored a lot of books. How did that come about?
I always wanted to be a writer. Always, always, always wanted to be a writer. And essentially, I think that there came a point in my teaching career that a couple of forces collided. Number one, I looked up, now I was an inner city Los Angeles high school English teacher, and I looked up and I swear we must have had 1,600 copies of Pride and Prejudice on the shelf. I mean, somebody just loved that book so much they kept ordering and ordering and ordering. And, when I looked for the books that, like, my students would see their lives reflected on the pages, we didn't really have any. So that's when I told myself, I'm going to write a book for my students. And that was my first aspiration. And that book, lo and behold, it went from manuscript that was kind of almost getting bootlegged around the campus, which taught me, if you build it, they will come, to self-publishing my first novel because, it was at the sort of dawn of AOL and the internet, and you could have a copy editor in Chicago, and you could get your artwork done in New York, and you could have it printed in Canada, and editor proofreading it in Seattle, and all through AOL in a way. It was remarkable. So I self-published it, and it kind of caught fire, caught the attention of an agent who eventually got it to a publisher. Next thing you know, Disney offered me a three-book deal. And I'm like, I was quite articulate. I'm like, duh.
Yeah, exactly. When Disney comes a knocking, you say,
Right.
"Where do I start?"
And that was, and I think my I'm getting ready to produce my 10th or 11th book just with Disney, with like the same editorial team over there. And I've since written for Scholastic and Penguin and Triumph Learning I do work for. So it's been, I've been really fortunate on that front.
So what book are you working on right now?
The big one right now is my forthcoming young adult novel is called Caged Warrior. Comes out in May of 2014, and I mean, and this is like, this book is spicy. It is raw. The gloves are off. And for those of you who sort of, like I said, this is not like, oh, it's probably, this book has content, okay? One of my most popular books is a book called Homeboys. And I mean, these books are, they are R-rated. There's no doubt about it. Cage Warrior is about a group of underaged, underground teenagers who sort of start an illegal fight club in the back of an abandoned Detroit middle school, since Detroit as a city just declared bankruptcy, and like, where is the law and this and that type of thing. And this, our protagonist has got this dad who's kind of like that psycho dad who, we've seen it with quarterbacks and we've seen it with tennis players, we've seen it with golfers, but this dad wants to raise his kid to be the first purebred pound for pound MMA fighter stud of the century. And yet the dad is kind of like a pimp who's whoring him out, turning violent tricks, making money off the side gambling debts. It's like I said, the gloves are off on this one.
Now, do you get a lot of pushback being an educator and writing things that could be seen as controversial?
No, you know why? Because I'm the guy that gets kids reading. I'm the guy that gets those 11th graders who are like, reading sucks. By page two, they're like, yo, dude, this book is for real. And, you know, though, and part of the, pedagogical strategy, if you will, that validates what I'm doing is, building bridges of access and relevance, because you're never going to get a kid to read his 100th book until they've read their first book. And
Right.
it's all great to stand on the mountain and be like, well, these kids should, and these kids should, and these kids should, but where the rubber meets the road, fact is, we're living in a nation filled with a ton of 11th graders who have 3rd and 4th grade reading levels that will step up to the plate and struggle with text if they are authentically engaged in the material that's in front of them. And right. if you think that you can throw the importance of meaningfulness, of validity and being engaged in the story and so forth, you know, you just go to Baltimore, go to Chicago, go to Oakland, go to Miami, come to Los Angeles, visit Houston, go to Dallas, right? Michigan. I mean, this is a national issue we're talking about. Right. And the fact is, a lot of my fans, they don't read Harry Potter. I mean, I loved Harry Potter. Like, there's, you know, there's a lot of fans there, and they're not reading Twilight, you know? They want that hard scrabble, real deal, you know, punch you in the teeth type of stuff that reflects their lives and the struggles they're going through. That is who this book is for.
Yeah, that's awesome. What advice would you give to students who are trying to write their own book, such as myself?
Oh, excellent. You know, I almost at the top air about when logged in, I ended up starting a website. So many kids asked me, you know, how to get started and stuff. And I think it's great because it was really, you know, I started writing before the internet. So it wasn't like just Google it, tap an author and send him an email, right? Like, you had to sort of, you know, walk both ways uphill in the snow barefoot, like Abe Lincoln. To go
fuck them off. Oh, man, that quote.
So I started an online and totally free something called the Writer Success Academy. So it's just writersuccess.com. And what a sweet web domain I got. Like, I couldn't believe it was available.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of trying to fill it up with tips, advice, tools for young writers where you can go to sort of learn the craft, become better informed and stuff like that, because the internet has been a game changer. I mean, there's no doubt in every way, shape, and form the game has changed, but the rules of storytelling have not. The ideas of how to create character and build, I mean, you know, it's like there are authors like Victor Hugo has done it better than, you know, anybody almost has ever done it in certain ways. And those are, you know, those principles that are underneath great storytelling, they're timeless. So a lot of, you know, how do you become a writer is embedded in, you know, lessons we've known prior to the digital age sort of stepping forward. However, being able to offer your story and share your story and communicate it, the tools for spreading story, they have just exploded. And it's kind of, you know, it's a really awesome time to be a storyteller. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people who are telling stories that just don't have their chops. You know, you've got to roll up your shirt sleeves, put your butt in a chair, and learn craft if you're going to make a difference.
Yeah, that's cool. So what's your favorite book for students and for you professionally?
A single favorite book is tough. There's a lot of books that have done different things for me at different points in my life. How old are you, Keegan?
17.
You're 17. So when I was 17, two books, like, stood out for me. One book is called The Alchemist. You ever hear of The Alchemist?
Yeah.
Man,
yeah.
Paulo Coelho. Alchemist was like, loved that book. Another book when I was 17, I read Les Miserables. Okay, I mentioned Victor Hugo. Now I'm back on him right here. And now this was my first 1,200-page book. And I'm like, when I first, you know, crossed paths, I'm like, no way, right? And then I'm like, page 873, I'm realizing, oh, my God, this thing's going to end. Like, what am I going to do? This book isn't long enough. And then I remember it was like a Saturday night, you know, and I'm just about to cross the 1,000-page mark. And when you're 17, it's Saturday night. It's like, I will see you when the cows wake up, you know, that kind of thing. And my buddy's like, all right, man, let's go out. We're going. And I'm like, man, I'm staying home. They're like, staying home to do what? And I'm like, I'm going to read. And they're just like, who the hell are you? I'm like, no, you don't understand, man. Like, there's Javert and Jean Valjean, and if I got to explain it to you, you know, you're not going to get it. And, but that was, you know, that was one of those things. And, you know, I have no idea what I missed out on that Saturday night, but Victor Hugo, and like, it's still with me. You know, these books become a part of your life. So, you know, and those are the type of things that sort of happen to readers, and I guess that's what builds writers in a way.
Now, what about professionally? Is there a book that you've read that has really made an impact on you professionally?
Well, on the English teacher front or on the writer front? Because, you know,
well,
it's kind of like I'm the guy who merges both, but they're really kind of separate tracks in a way.
Whichever one. I mean, either one. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I believe in reading and studying and things like that. So every time that I'm about to start a book project, I either go find a book I haven't read on writing or go back through my sort of dog-eared pages of books. For aspiring writers, I mean, I don't think any of the books I'm about to name are any great secret, but as a professional writer, I can tell you they stand tall. One of which is Stephen King wrote a book called On Writing, which, you know, and I've never really read a Stephen King book. Like, he scares me, you know? Like, that's all there is. I'm a wuss, right? I'm not going to read a book like It, right? I'll have to sleep with the lights on forever, okay? Yeah. I mean, and there are people who, like, that's their thing. For me, too freaky, okay? So, like, he never really wrote, you know, but I read his book On Writing, and I realized, man, this guy takes his craft super serious, you know? He talks about, like, understanding grammar and phrasing and sentence construction, and he makes this toolkit analogies. And you think, oh, Stephen King, he's just trying to scare the pants off me, and he's really good at it. But he treats it like a professional writer. And that was something that just really sort of caught me in a way that I was like, wow. You know, and the book is filled with a lot of helpful tools and tips and stuff. On the teacher front, there are certainly a lot of books out there. I kind of try to do author studies. You know, some of my favorite. I'm lucky. I'm kind of friends with these guys too now. But like I read Jeff Wilhelm. Jim Burke, monster fan of the work that Kyleen Beers, there's Nancy Atwell, you know, there's Fisher and Frey, there's all sorts of people who are doing stuff in the teacher world, that it's not that big of a world, especially for secondary English language arts. That, you know, now that I mentioned some people, my goodness, I don't want to forget others. You know, Kelly Gallagher has done some great stuff, Penny Kittles. So it's like if you're in secondary English teaching, you know, there's 10 to 15 names, and they're up there because they're worth it.
Now, you were also California's Teacher of the Year in 2007, like you mentioned earlier. How did that happen, and what was that like?
First of all, you can't chart a course for it. You never expect it. You're basically given, like, I was named, I mean, here's how it happened for me. I don't know how the Teacher of the Year happens for other people, but I was told, by someone at the district office that I was going to be named Linwood High School Teacher of the Year. And I was like, oh, thank you. You know, that's great. And then they give me an application to fill out for District Teacher of the Year. And it was like a simple thing, and I'm like, and they encouraged me, and I'm like, well, you're going to name me high school teacher, I got to fill out. So I fill out this thing, and then I'm named District Teacher of the Year. And then they hand me another application, and they're like, now you got to fill out this one for Los Angeles County Teacher of the Year. And it's like 15 pages long. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no. No. Who's got time to write, like, you know, these, like, 8 or 9 really deep essays and filling out the paperwork?
You're writing a dissertation.
Right. It's just like, you know, I'm like, I don't have time. And the day before it was due, you know, I'm just like, kind of out of guilt, like I'm going to let these guys down. You know, they named me District Teacher of the Year, and if I don't fill it out, I'm going to, you know, they're not going to have a candidate. You know, and then I'm going to hear grief, and, you know, it's like, so I'm like, okay. So I do it, and you put in all these hours, and I fill out these essays and stuff like that. And then it turns out that I was selected to be one of Los Angeles County's Teacher of the Year. And that's when it started getting real, because L.A. County has got, like, a lot of teachers. L.A. County, I mean, it's not just L.A. Unified. It's L.A. County must service nearly 2 million students. So I'm like one of their teachers of the year. I'm like, whoa. And then next thing I know, it's like I'm going to be interviewed by Sacramento for California Teacher of the Year. So they send some people that are going to teach a lesson in my class. You know, I got to teach a sample lesson in my classroom. And then they come down and I'm selected and they fly me up to Sacramento and there's interviews around these conference tables with people, you know, really stern asking you questions and you're nervous. But for me, I'm just like, you know what? I'm shooting from the, you know, it's like I got a life, a job, and you don't expect to win. You just bring your A game. There's no way to prepare. And voila, you know, you get this phone call and you think it's a buddy pranking you. Right? That's really it. You've been named California Teacher of the Year. It's like, yeah, right, you know? And like, no, serious, you know? It's an we're bestowing this honor on you, you know? It's wear a tie. I'm like, really? You know? So that's kind of how it happened.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is.
That's awesome. I always find myself surrounded by teachers at all times. So I was wondering, who is there any teacher that stuck out to you personally? Maybe it was as a child or someone that you even worked with. Any one teacher that you think just made an impact on you?
Well, absolutely. I don't think anybody becomes a teacher unless they had a teacher that reached them. I just think that there's something about it. I just want to say one thing, though, about the whole Teacher of the Year award process. One thing that they do a great job of reiterating behind the scenes, this is not you're the best teacher, right? I mean, there's nothing. It's more like you're an ambassador to the profession and, you know, try not to, you know, fumble it, right? But go out there. Do your thing and try to put teachers in a positive light. I see so many teachers that are doing such great work in so many different areas with so many different challenges that, you know, the idea that, like, you're the best teacher, it just rings hollow. And it's an incredible opportunity that it's opened up for my life because I get to meet so many teachers and work with them and travel and speak and do professional development. But this is, you know, it's also, there's a lot of humility about the fact that, you know, as soon as you think you got this job nailed, you meet that kid who teaches you, man. You thought you knew how to educate me? And he'll send you home pulling your hair out. So I just feel like I needed to say that because it really is that it's a very humbling profession. And anybody who comes to it without that humility is quickly humbled by the work because no matter how hard you work and no matter what you do right now in America, there's always more to give. I mean, it's a vacuum cleaner that never turns off and you can burn out, get exhausted, lay every inch of your soul on the line, and still there's more to do.
Yeah, that's awesome. And if you were in charge of making every decision dealing with public education, what's one big thing that you would change?
Here's where I get to pander. Number one, I would put a moratorium on standardized testing. The bubble tests are a farce, okay? It's not that I don't believe in assessment. I don't believe in crappy assessment. And I think that if we take a two-year moratorium and we take all the money we're spending on testing and test prep and put it back into our schools and professionally develop the teachers and get our classrooms up to snuff and actually resource our kids, that would be a much better use of funding than spending it on tests where we already know the results. And the fact of the matter is, if you really want to know how a kid is doing in the month of May, you don't need to test them. You need to trust in a teacher's assessment of that child. Because that right there, you know, the further away you are from the teacher-student relationship, the further away you are from authentically being able to measure it. And anybody who tells you different has a vested interest, probably politically, in the assessment movement. Because as soon as we re-empower our teachers to be the assessors, we can sort of move away. I mean, right now, there's talk about the SAT, but, you know, there's a big wave about the SAT is a farce. You know, is it really giving colleges this insight into an individual's aptitude in the way that we want it to? No. What it's doing is it's like the best we can kind of do, but the internet is made. We can do better. Individual portfolios, digital portfolios, tracking student growth from 7th grade to 12th grade, and like digital lockers and things like that. And a college can take a look inside and see where were you and how have you done, and let's see your papers, and let's see your project-based learning, and let's see your schedules, you know. Way more insightful than an SAT with a cooked-up, you know, essay that your, you know, some test prep company is you've outsourced anyway for helping writing. So right. Testing itself, and the fact of the matter is, you know, I look and see a lot of kids who are classified and categorized as underperforming, and these kids have wicked skill sets just in other domains of aptitude. So it's because we diminish, you know, and Howard Gardner has talked about multiple, you know, the theory of multiple aptitudes and things. I mean, this is not new stuff, but if a kid is a kinesthetic learner or has the ability to really rock it through technology, they have no means to demonstrate their aptitude right now in our current world of assessment. It's basically, it's, you know, type black ink on a rectangular page and sit down, be quiet, test for 3.5 hours, and no, you can't get up to use the bathroom. And if you don't fit into that box, then education demonizes you. And the truth of the matter is, education is worse off for it. And I'm glad that this is live, and I'm glad that this is published, and I'm glad this is going out, because I stand behind that, you know, and maybe this will go viral. Chop it out, send it out there. Because
there we go. That's the goal. Here we go. We got the sound bite.
There's hundreds of thousands of parents, kids, and teachers out there that would be shouting, "Hallelujah, brother," from the mountaintop to what I just said.
I'm sure there's some people doing it right now, because I was holding back. I was going to say preach on, but I was letting you point out.
Yep.
So I know Keegan mentioned it a minute ago, but I don't think you got to it. What is a teacher? Who is a teacher that had a big impact on you?
It's funny, because probably one of the biggest teachers that had an impact on me was my Algebra 2 teacher in high school, a math teacher. She was, and I love her. So, Ms. Young, I'm teasing. But I thought she was 150 years old in high school. And she's still around. I don't know if she's still teaching, but she's still around. But she didn't take none of my nonsense, right? She was like, in class, she would just give me that look. And she was like, not only am I not taking any of your junk, but I'm expecting you to reach down deeper and try harder than you ever have before. And I will take nothing less from you, sir. And she was able to communicate that and reach into me in a way that was like, she believed in me, but she drove me, you know? And that was something that I, you know, like, especially because in language arts, I've always been a great student, you know? But like math, I kind of hit an edge. But she taught me the value of, like, just deeply believing in people, sometimes more than they believe in themselves.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you still keep in touch with her?
No. You know, I don't know that I ever even, shameful as this is, I even expressed to her what I just expressed to you. It's one of those things that, you know, it's like I'm a 17-year-old, right, with my head up my butt, and then I go away to college, and then, you know, it's like I'm doing this, I'm doing that. It's not till I, you know, hit my 40s that I'm like this sort of teacher and this and that, and then it's like I should look her up, but it's been 25 years, and I'm feel like I'm going to get in trouble or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you could go back 5 or 10 years and give yourself a piece of advice, what would you tell yourself?
That's great. Number one, I 5 or 10 years ago is when my kind of I dawned in a way, and I just started taking my advice 5 or 10 years ago in terms of like professionally. But if I could go back to when I was Keegan's age, I would certainly cultivate that listen to your heart inner strength in myself, because I unfortunately think that the influence of my peers played too much of a significant role on my own sense of self-esteem to my detriment. And I would say that, you know what? And it's a common mistake of youth, right? It's a common mistake of youth of thinking that their opinion should rightfully shape my actions. And I always was one that people probably looked to like, man, that guy does follow his heart. He does march to his own, you know, beat of his own drum type of thing. And yet still on the inside, there was that war and wrestling match, and are they going to like me, and do they care, and this and that. And that really held me back for years of my life. And once I finally let it go, and I'd be like, man, I'm playing for keeps, right? I'm a good person. I don't have any ill will towards anybody, but I want to step up and swing big time for the fences, you know? And it wasn't until I unleashed that part of me that I felt professionally fulfilled.
Right. If someone were to describe you in 3 words, what 3 words would you hope they would use?
What 3 words would I hope they would use? Positive. Positively influential, you know. And, third word, I guess I would say just, you know, solid, right? You know, right. I guess kind of those 3 things. You know, yeah. I don't spend much time thinking about
yourself.
That stuff. I spend a lot of time thinking about how I treat other people, how I behave, that my own character, virtues, ethics, codes type of thing. But I don't spend much time, you know, if it washes with me now, then it washes. That's kind of it right there. And when people take offense at what I do, like, and trust me, you talked, Todd, about when you get pushback about I'm writing novels, man, that have, you know, they're violent, there's language, there's stuff going on that's raw. And when I get pushback from conservative educators, first of all, I listen, because I don't think my books are for everyone, right? I'm not out there saying, well, you know, you should. You know. It's like I'm a parent, too. I believe in curation. I don't want – my daughter is 7.5 years old right now. She shouldn't be reading my books. Like, sometimes she comes over to my computer, and I got to, like, toggle off to something else, right? Like, she can read. She reads some of that language. That's inappropriate. But on the other hand, when she gets to be a certain age, you know, and she wants to read it, you know, have at it. But that's why when teachers come to me, they're like, I feel the stuff is inappropriate for my kids. I'm like, good. I'm glad you're stepping up.
Right? Yeah.
It's like somebody should filter, because kids who are exposed to things they shouldn't be exposed to at too early of an age, that stuff causes problems. I mean, I firmly believe that.
Yep. And one thing we always like to end on is the question of, what are you really passionate about right now?
What am I really passionate about right now is I am really passionate about going for it, whatever that might mean. You know, I mean, there's a side of life that sometimes we get fearful, and fear inhibits our ability to really go after those things we personally find meaningful. And right now, I'm ready to roll up my shirt sleeves and jump in the mud and freaking alligator wrestle with my fear, because I'm not going to let it dominate my life going forward. And that right there is, took me a long time to get to this point. But, like I said, we're playing for keeps on planet Earth. And there's people out there and think, oh, tomorrow, oh, one day, or oh, there's nobody promised another day, right? Nobody promised another chance. So freaking go for it.
Man, there are so many quotable moments in this interview, I swear.
Yeah.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for coming on with us tonight and giving us some of your time.
Thank you.
I know it's still early in the evening for you, but Keegan, who's on the other coast, is a little bit later. But we really appreciate you giving us some of your time and talking with us. This was a pure blast, so thank you.
Oh, awesome, man. You guys rock. I'm really, really happy to support and keep up the great work.
And for those of you that are listening, some ways that you can connect with us are on Twitter via our Twitter handle, which is EduAllStarsHQ. And you can tweet using the hashtag EduAllStars so we can see the stuff you're sharing about the show. You can also visit our website, EduAllStars.com, and see all the other interviews that have been done, all the other 35, and check out some of them. Or you can listen to them on iTunes by just searching out EduAllStars, one word with no spaces.
Yep, and don't miss our next interview with Kyle Pace on Monday, February 24th at 8 o'clock Central Standard Time. And then on March 3rd, we're going to have Mrs. Jump from Teachers Pay Teachers at 7:30 Central Standard Time.
And if you're still with us, we'd love for you to leave us some feedback on iTunes and leave a review and let us know what you thought of the show. Again, Alan, thank you so much. And thank you, Keegan, for being here our first episode.
I love it.
So we will catch all of you later. Thanks again, Alan.
Bye, you guys. Excellent. Good luck with the program.
Thank you.